From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Electoral challenges and confidence in democracy. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The latest polls show Republicans picking up steam among likely voters. Races for the Senate and Congress could be closer than ever. Both parties are mobilizing thousands of lawyers, with Republicans concentrating on possible fraud and Democrats focused on access. On To the Point, we'll hear about possible challenges to voter ID, electronic voting, and absentee ballots. How long will it take before we know who's in charge on Capitol Hill? Will challenges and delays damage confidence in American democracy? On Reporter's Notebook later on, ballot measures challenging judicial independence. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. With more and more races getting closer and closer, both parties have thousands of lawyers ready to challenge various stages of the electoral process. On To the Point, how long will it take before we know who controls the next Congress? Will challenges and delays damage confidence in American democracy? On Reporter's Notebook, if citizens don't like court decisions, should they be able to sue the judge? First, this news update. Yesterday's death sentence for Saddam Hussein has outraged Sunnis and led to predictions that sectarian differences might never be resolved. But today, Iraq's Shiite-dominated government offered what could be a major concession. Borzu Daragahi reports from Baghdad. He's the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Always good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
This has, as I understand it, to do with the Ba'ath Party purged by the original American occupiers. What does it provide?
Well, first of all, I should caution that this is just a draft proposal that hasn't even been introduced into Parliament yet. They're going to introduce it into Parliament. I think that it's important to note also that the Iraqi government is under tremendous pressure by the U.S., has been under pressure to enact something of this kind, a reconciliation gesture toward the Sunnis. And this is obviously or apparently in response to that kind of pressure. It's long overdue in the estimate of many people. What happened is that a lot of people joined the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein's political party, because they had to. They had no choice. It was the only way they could get ahead in their career. And a lot of these people were later purged from their offices, purged from their jobs because of that association, even though they had committed no specific crimes. And this is meant to redress that issue.
In the meantime, how much of a figure is Saddam Hussein in Iraq at this point? Is he important enough that he really could engender even more sectarian violence than we've already seen?
I don't think that he's that important as a figure. I think that a lot of people have laid him to rest already in the past few years. But I think he does represent a symbol for some people, and it is a provocation, this death penalty and the way this trial was carried out and the overt sectarian semiotics of the trial. You had a Shiite prosecutor, a Kurdish judge, and a Sunni defendant being defended by other Sunnis. And that is not helpful. That element of theater makes this more of an inflammatory court ruling, a court session, than something that would bring about reconciliation or healing or justice.
We're talking with Borzu Daragahi, the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Well, the appeals process will take some time. Is it possible that in the meantime, some other trial that seems to have more credibility and also involve more people, more atrocities than this one did, is it possible that such a trial could take place?
Well, I think the Anfal case, for example, it's continuing. It's going to resume tomorrow. We're sending a pool reporter there to cover the trial tomorrow. So that case is continuing. That is the case in which Saddam Hussein's government allegedly ordered the month-long campaign, the Anfal campaign against Kurdish villagers in the north, killing tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, many of them women and children. That case will continue.
So it will continue. That's as opposed to the one he's now been convicted of, where 148 Shiites were killed. Plenty of people, certainly. But the point is, would there be another trial? Would this other trial you're talking about have more credibility with the Sunni people?
I think this other trial might have a little bit more credibility, but I think the well is already poisoned at this point. In the minds of many Sunni Arabs, this is a government that's not legitimate. It never was legitimate, and any court it spawns is not legitimate. This is going to take years to overcome. In the minds of many Sunni people, and this is the major problem of Iraq, the Shiites, many of them, the Sunnis don't even consider them Iraqi. They say this is not an Iraqi government. This is an Iranian government. And basically what they're saying is that, you know, they don't recognize the Shiite experience in Iraq. They don't recognize the Kurdish experience in Iraq as valid experiences. And that's the root of the problem here.
We have, of course, in the neighborhood of 100 people dying every day in Iraq. What's happening now on the streets of Baghdad and other cities? I understand there was, at least for a time, a sort of universal curfew.
Yeah, there has been this curfew in place. It has spanned to violence. The number of bodies showing up is not as high as it has been in the past. As U.S. and Iraqi security forces have shown in the past, and they demonstrated clearly today, if they lock down all the cities and if they stop road traffic, they can control violence at the cost of ordinary civic and commercial life.
So order at the expense of ordinary business.
Exactly. I mean, it's not sustainable. You can't have a pedestrian curfew. You can't have, in a city like Baghdad, you can't have a vehicle curfew for longer than a few days. It's just not possible.
All right. Well, of course, we'll be tracking this as usual. Barzu Daragahi, always good to talk with you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Baghdad Bureau Chief, Los Angeles Times. In a moment, will electoral challenges erode confidence in American democracy? On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To The Point. The latest polls suggest that Democrats' national lead over Republicans may be shrinking. The prospect of more and more close races means there could be challenges at various stages of the electoral process. Democrats and Republicans have mobilized thousands of lawyers, and the Federal Department of Justice is sending 800 lawyers to 65 cities in 20 states. We'll talk about all that in a few moments. First, let's talk about the polls with John Mercurio. He's senior editor of National Journal's Hotline. Always good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Pew Center for the Public and the Poll and the Press, the research center, now says Republicans outnumber Democrats among likely voters. What's the significance of that?
Well, there are several polls out over the past weekend, and that for the Pew Center poll is one that Republicans, I think, are most encouraged by. There's also a CNN poll, a USA Today Gallup poll, an ABC News Washington Post poll, all of them showing different numbers of voter, specifically on the issue of voter intensity, which is one that Republicans have been lagging behind Democrats on throughout the year. So it's difficult to get a real sense of where things stand in terms of voter intensity, but it does look as though Republicans are closing the gap in the final days.
Is this something that Republicans say they've expected all along?
Well, to some extent, sure. I mean, I think a lot of Republicans and a lot of the people in the media watching these elections closely expected that Republicans were going to close the gap. To some extent, I think it's a product of this tremendous financial advantage that Republicans traditionally enjoy and continue to enjoy this year. They've been able to pour significantly more money into some of these competitive Senate races, into these competitive congressional House races, and that's helped them close the gap. That's helped them protect some of their more vulnerable incumbents.
What about recent news, the guilty verdict for Saddam Hussein, for example, and the president's campaigning?
Well, it's too early at this point to gauge in any of these polls exactly what the reaction among voters will be to Saddam Hussein's conviction that, of course, only came out yesterday. But both Republicans and Democrats say that it's unlikely, considering how widely expected that development was, it's unlikely to have too much of an impact on the race. I think at this point, in terms of a November surprise, you need something to be exactly that, a surprise, something that would dramatically change the direction that these elections are heading.
Does it appear that President Bush, with his campaigning in very sort of carefully chosen places, does that seem to have made a difference?
You know, I think it has made a difference in one race, and one major race that we're watching closely, and that's the Montana Senate race. He was Conrad Burns has been extremely vulnerable all year. I think sometime in early October, most Republicans just sort of gave him up for gone, figuring that his race was over. President Bush went out to Montana last week. This is a state that he won by about 40 points, I believe, 30 or 40 points in the 2004 presidential campaign. He remains extremely popular out there, and I think he's been able to make a difference in Conrad Burns' race. Now we're seeing polls that show Conrad Burns and his Democratic challenger, John Tester, essentially tied. That might have made a difference. On the other hand, you have several other races around the country where the president's campaigned, and it hasn't made any difference. In fact, the Democrat has opened up leads, such as Michigan. I know that the president was out campaigning for Mike Bouchard, the Republican Senate candidate, and the Democratic incumbent, Debbie Stabenow, has since widened her lead.
And we have some Republicans keeping their distance from the president, as they have been doing, including particularly the Republican candidate for governor of Florida today.
That was very interesting. Yeah, the president going down to Pensacola, which is probably the most Republican part of a very competitive state, Florida. This is the Florida panhandle where President Bush will be campaigning. And the Republican gubernatorial candidate, who's the only real star on the Florida ballot for the Republican Party, decided to distance himself from him, saying he already has Pensacola and the whole panhandle locked up, and he wants to campaign elsewhere around the state, which does make sense from a strategic standpoint. But from a political standpoint within Republican Party politics, it was not a nice thing to do to the president, who now has to basically stand on a stage with his brother, the current governor, and Catherine Harris, the very unpopular Senate candidate.
One who is very likely to lose. Apparently disparaging comment from Karl Rove about all of this said something to the effect that how could he get a better crowd wherever else he's going than he could in Pensacola with the president.
Exactly.
So mixed reviews then for the president and his participation in this election. John Mercurio, before I let you go, do you think that if there are in fact many and many closer races, as it would appear that there may well be, that there could be enough challenges to really delay the count and that it may take us some time before we find out who really won?
Absolutely. I mean, in my home state of Maryland, I'm watching very closely these two very competitive races for governor and for Senate. There's been a significant amount of early voting done in Maryland this year. I think as many as 80% of the voters are projected to vote early in that state, and we might not know the results of that election for some time, which is just a delay of the election. But in addition to that, I think you're right. I think there are going to be a significant number of people who are skeptical about the results, and the legal challenges are more than likely.
Okay. Well, we'll be talking about that throughout our program. Thanks for getting us off to a good start.
Thank you.
John Mercurio, senior editor, National Journal's Hotline. Rick Hassan is professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He's also author of an election law blog. And Rick Hassan, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Many people are saying that this is going to be sort of a record year in terms of challenges to the electoral process. I think you're one of them. Bring us up to date. Why do you think that is, and where do you think the biggest problems are likely to happen?
Well, we've seen since the 2000 Florida debacle a marked rise in the number of suits that have been filed. So I did a study before 2000. We saw an average of about 96 election challenge cases a year, and that number went up to 254. So that's about a 250% increase since 2000, and we're seeing litigation all over the country. It's partly the result of the parties being a little less shy about going to court to challenge close elections or election processes, and partly I think it is some of the changes that the country tried to make to deal with the Florida-like problems, changing our voting machinery, changing our voting rules, have at least in the short term created some uncertainty. And that uncertainty leaves room for lawyers to start arguing over the proper means for counting and casting votes.
The particular act involved the HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, which required in many cases that outdated machinery or outdated processes be replaced by machines. Where has that caused the biggest problems, do you think, or is it too early to tell?
Well, we had a number of problems back in 2004, you may remember, in the months before the presidential election. There was a flurry of activity in court over whether votes cast in the wrong precinct. So you're a voter and you're supposed to go to precinct one and you go to precinct two, whether that vote should be counted under HAVA. So there were some legal questions that arose then. More of HAVA has kicked in place for 2006. Most importantly, requirements of statewide databases to check voter identification. And there have been all kinds of questions about these databases and whether eligible voters have been taken off the rolls and how the systems are going to work, electronic systems in some places to try and track voters. And so I think we have a guarantee that tomorrow there are going to be some election problems, but that doesn't necessarily translate into a kind of national crisis like we saw in 2000.
There also have been, as you mentioned, voter IDs. There are states which now require voter IDs in some places where that the laws of that kind have been upheld and repealed, and there's some confusion as to whether they're really in effect or not.
Yes, that's right. So we've had a number of states, including Missouri, which is one of the important states for the outcome of the Senate, where the state Supreme Court has prevented the voter ID law from going into effect. In other places, like Arizona, the voter ID law is going into effect, but a few weeks ago we thought it wasn't because the Ninth Circuit said don't do it, and then the Supreme Court came back and in a surprise opinion that no one was expecting said, no, go ahead and use those rules. So there's a lot of last-minute changes in terms of the rules, and that's causing some confusion among poll workers and no doubt among voters as well.
We have lawyers for both parties, Republicans and Democrats, reportedly thousands of them around the country, and the Justice Department is sending 800 lawyers to 65 cities in 20 states. What are they going to be doing, and how did they choose those 65 cities and 20 states?
I don't know how they made those choices, but the Voting Rights Act and other federal statutes give the Justice Department authority to observe elections and to make sure that there are not problems. I think you're going to find in places like Missouri, in places like Maryland, where there are close elections and disputes over procedures, you're going to find not only Justice Department lawyers in polling places, you're also going to find Democratic and Republican lawyers either challenging voters or defending voters who are being challenged. And it may be that there's going to be an attempt to lay the groundwork for potential litigation after the election if, in fact, we have a very close race and there are problems with how the election is administered.
And obviously, litigation after the election could, in fact, delay when we know who's going to be in control of the Congress.
Oh, that's absolutely true. But what I'd say is even without litigation, and I think we're all hoping that litigation can be avoided if it's at all possible, there is likely to be a delay if there's a very close race for the simple reason that we have seen an unprecedented amount of early voting and absentee voting. And to the extent that there are absentee votes that are not being processed until Election Day, that's where the signatures are checked and you make sure that these absentee ballots that come in are valid ones, there could be a delay of 2 or 3 days. The American public is impatient, and it will be a media circus if, for example, in Maryland, we're waiting to find out the outcome of the Senate race, and the Senate hangs on that. But election officials have to do their job, and it's not uncommon for things to get a little bit delayed when you're counting so many absentee votes.
Rick Hassan, professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, author of the Election Law blog. You mentioned Maryland, so did John Mercurio a moment ago, the National Journal Hotline. Audra Miller is a spokesperson for the Maryland Republican Party. Ms. Miller, thanks for joining us. Ms. Miller, are you with us? Okay.
Hello, I'm right here.
There you are. Thank you. We finally found you.
How are you today?
Very well, very well. Tell us about 80%, perhaps, of early voting in Maryland won't be counted until tomorrow, those absentee ballots. Just that alone, how much is that going to delay the outcome, do you think?
It will delay, and we're prepared for that. The absentee ballots will not begin to be counted until Thursday. But we have done a major push, both parties, both Republican and and Democratic parties in the state have done a major push with absentees because of the insecurity with the electronic voting machines, the flaws, and our electronic poll books shutting down during the primary. It has really increased the demand for absentee ballots. Now, one of the issues, though, we're finding here is in the push to get voters to do absentee ballots, the Democratic Party here in Maryland has done some troubling things. Returning the absentee ballot, we have our voters returning the absentee ballot to the local boards of elections. Well, the Democratic Party in Maryland is, in fact, having the voters send back their applications to the state Democratic Party. Now, the question arises, are they throwing out applications of voters they don't think will vote for their candidates? Now, purely that's speculation, but it does give them the ability to do that by throwing them out. But more troubling is the fact that the state Democratic Party is bundling these absentee ballots. What they're doing is holding on to them till they have several hundred or even 1,000 applications, and then they're dropping them off at the local boards, intentionally bottlenecking the local boards and the process, creating delays. We're getting calls, hundreds of calls today about voters that have not yet received their absentee ballots, and this is one of the causes for it.
Okay, we don't have a Democrat from Maryland on the line. We're going to go to Missouri in a moment. We'll hear from a Democrat there. But let me go back to Rick Hassan at Loyola Law School. The Democrats are concerned in Maryland about a Republican pamphlet that's been handed out. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a pamphlet that the Washington Post was able to get a hold of and posted on their website, which details how Republican vote observers should go ahead, and they are instructed that their first job is to challenge voters who appear not to be eligible to vote. And Democrats are claiming that this is a vote suppression exercise. What you're basically seeing is, and this is really a post-2000 trend, is that the parties have become more aggressive and election administration has become more politicized. So instead of moving in the what I would think is the right direction towards neutral election administration where we all have confidence in who's running our elections, it's become more politicized, and so you have these disputes over absentee ballots or over voter challenges because there's so much room for people who have lack of confidence to try and come in and create the conditions where even if there's not going to be litigation, there's at least going to be a decline in voter confidence that's associated with how we run our elections.
Audra Miller, back to you. What about this pamphlet? Do you, in fact, intend to challenge IDs? Is that, as Democrats claim, a way of trying to keep the vote down so that fewer Democrats will be registered?
No, those are baseless allegations. The Poll Watcher program is authorized by state law, and it was, in fact, established by the Democrats in our General Assembly. This is a program that both parties use, and it is strictly according to Maryland law. Our poll watchers are out there to ensure that we have an honest election, that people are that can vote do vote, and that there is no fraud. The fact is, this poll watcher program is really about training our people to their statutory duties in accordance with the law. It's being used in previous elections by both parties without controversy. Now, what we're seeing, though, is that the state Democratic Party has taken this, in light of the polls really tightening here, and they're crying at voter suppression.
Okay.
Well, this, in fact, comes from a Kerry Edwards Election Day manual that we distributed that says, look, even if there isn't voter suppression or intimidation, launch a preemptive strike.
All right, we've got to keep it there. We'll be back in a moment with the state most likely to be ripe for challenges on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, talking today about challenges to the voting that will occur tomorrow, challenges which could, in fact, delay the vote count, and how much we know about who's going to control the Congress for days to come. Today's Washington Post says, move over Florida, you to Ohio, the state most ripe for voting disputes in tomorrow's voting, according to election law experts across the ideological spectrum, may well be Missouri. Rob Hege is general counsel for the Missouri Democratic Party. Rob Hege, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having us.
Why is Missouri, other than the fact that it has one of the closest races in the country for the U.S. Senate, so likely to be ripe for challenges?
Well, we don't think there are going to be a lot of big challenges. I mean, we're cautiously optimistic, but as your previous callers referred to, we do have a program where we are going to have challengers in the polling places across the state to ensure that the election authorities are doing their job, and then also to ensure that every registered voter in Missouri gets a chance to vote and that their vote will be accurately tabulated at the end of the day. We do have a system here based on HAVA where we have our two largest election authorities in St. Louis City and County and Kansas City that are going to be using new election machines. This will be the second time that they've used these machines. The other one was our primary in August, and that is certainly an area that is of concern to the Democrats as to how this will actually work on Election Day, and it's something that we intend to monitor throughout the day and into the evening if necessary.
All right. HAVA, of course, once again, the Help America Vote Act passed by the Congress to try to clear up problems that began in the year 2000. Well, it didn't begin, but were most dramatic in the year 2000 in Florida. Well, Rob Hagee, it's my understanding that Missouri passed a photo ID law and that law was then struck down in court. Our Democrats, when you say everybody, you want to make sure everybody has a chance to vote, is that something you're particularly confused about, that poll workers might be that you're concerned about, rather, that poll workers themselves might be confused?
Well, we are concerned about that, and our Secretary of State has run an advertising campaign across the state indicating to all the voters that photo identification is not required. We certainly communicated that to all the election authorities, and there have been a couple of instances where they've been a little slow to get the message, but everybody seems to be coming into the awareness of what the law is and what it provides for on Election Day, and we don't anticipate a lot of problems as long as the election judges follow the law, which clearly states that you do not have to have photo ID to vote on Election Day.
Republicans are accusing your party of having a history of voter fraud in this state, and the liberal group ACORN, not affiliated with the party, but once again a liberal group, has now seen some indictments for people who are alleged to have submitted false voter registrations. Do you think that's going to be a problem?
No, we really don't, because, you know, frankly, that shows to me it's more proof that our voter registration system is working, and that the cards were checked by the election authorities, and they were across in Democratic counties and Republican counties, and they were turned over to the local prosecutors, and they're going to be prosecuted vigorously. And frankly, it's the position of the Democratic Party that they should be. Our problems in Missouri have not been the result of people trying to vote that are not entitled to vote. They've been the problems as identified by the Department of Justice of really systematic failure in our voting processes that prohibit people from voting by not having enough equipment in the polling places, not having enough telephone lines in polling places. And that's really what's caused the problems in Missouri. So it's not a question of voter fraud. It's really a question of voters being disenfranchised by not enough materials and correct equipment in polling places.
This is said to be the most important race at the moment in terms of who's going to ultimately end up controlling the Senate, with Jim Talent, the Republican, being challenged by the Democrat Claire McCaskill. Are you Democrats prepared for a recount and all the expense and time and difficulty that would cause if, in fact, it comes out very closely?
Well, definitely. We've been monitoring that situation, and certainly we don't believe we're going to be in a recount situation, that we'll have a very comfortable victory on election night. But if we are, we will be in a position to monitor that and then participate in that process.
Again, Rob Hagee is general counsel for the Missouri Democratic Party. Let me go back to Audra Miller, whom we heard from earlier, spokesperson for the Maryland Republican Party. You have a very close Senate race there, too. Tell us who the candidates are, and same question to you. If, in fact, it's very close, do you have the resources to launch a recount?
Well, the Republican candidate is Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele, the first African American elected statewide in Maryland. He's running against 20-year incumbent Ben Cardin on the Democratic side.
Incumbent congressman.
Correct. Yes, sir. Excuse me. And as for a recount, what we're really hopeful is that that we can keep this out of the courts. that the voters decide this election, and as long as it takes to have an accurate, honest process, we're certainly willing and able to stick it out.
Recounts are estimated to cost in the neighborhood of $5 million, I think. Is that true in Maryland, and do you have that kind of money if, in fact, it gets down to that?
Well, I think because of the size of our state, I don't think the price would be nearly that
high. Wouldn't be that high.
Right. I think at the end of the day, to have a process with integrity, it's worth it.
All right. Again, Maryland, where the incumbent who's leaving office is a Democrat, and that obviously could make a difference if a Republican were to win, and Missouri, where the incumbent is a Republican. So we can see what's at stake in these various places. Thank you, Audra Miller, for being with us, and
thank
Rob Hege. Thanks to you as well. Question is, as Rick Hassan of Loyola Law School in Los Angeles just said, will these kinds of challenges, will delays in the vote count, cause people to lose confidence in the democratic system? Carlin Bowman is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, also senior editor of the American Enterprise magazine. Welcome to our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have recently written that according to polls you've seen, you think people have a lot of confidence in the system. Why is that, given what's been going on, the kind of reporting we've seen, the kind of thing we just heard from the various parties all the way since the year 2000?
Well, let me just give you one example of a poll conducted recently. There was an October 20 through 22 Gallup USA Today poll, which reported that 91% of those surveyed were either very or somewhat confident that the votes will be counted accurate, will be accurately cast and counted at the voting facility where they vote. So there is a lot of optimism about people's own personal experience. I think there are perhaps two reasons for this. First of all, we know generally in public opinion polling that people are a lot more confident about things at the local and state level than they are about things at the national level, and I think that explains some of the confidence that people have, but it also
could
be
worth pointing out once again that federal elections under the Constitution are handled by the states, and that means often by the county, so it does get very local.
That's right, and people are, as I said, generally very positive about their experiences with local government. I think also many Americans have been voting year after year, time after time, in lots of different kinds of elections, and they just haven't seen a lot of problems at their particular polling places in the past. If you look back to the 38 day imbroglio in 2000, you had only about 15% of Americans consistently saying that it was a crisis. And this isn't a way of vote of confidence in representative democracy. People think the system is going to work and they think it has worked in the past. And I think that explains the optimism about what's likely to happen in people's own voting places.
We also have seen, however, a big decline in the number of people and the percentage of eligible people who participate in elections. A lot of people think that that's because many of them think that the elections aren't fair. You don't, I take it, buy that.
I haven't seen survey data that would support that point. I think a lot of people, there are a lot of reasons people don't vote, but I've not ever seen that given as a reason for people not voting.
Carlin Bowman, again, at the American Enterprise Institute and American Enterprise Magazine. Thomas Patterson is professor of government and the press at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government, also author of The Vanishing Voter, came out in 2002. Professor, good to have you with us.
Well, thank you.
What's the reason for the vanishing voter?
Well, I think they're going to reappear tomorrow, as they did in 2004, when you have big issues like Iraq on the table. Americans do turn out to vote, but that's relative. Tomorrow we're going to have turnout that's below 50% of the eligible adults in the country, and you look around the world and you kind of ask why do we have 50% turnout in these midterms and a little more than 60% in the presidential election, and elsewhere we see 70, 80, 90%. And to me, my concern is more with things that are perfectly legal that we do to hold down the vote rather than kind of issues of fraud. Actually, we don't have very much fraud on the level of the individual voter, but we certainly have a lot of rules that historically, at least, and sometimes contemporaneously, are designed to keep people away from the polls, to suppress the vote as opposed to increase it.
Before we get to those and what you mean specifically, what about the challenges that we see and the great publicity that is given to them? Do you think that they are, and do you have poll evidence? Carlin Bowman says she never saw any, but do you have poll evidence that might be discouraging people from going to the polls?
Well, I would share her interpretation of the poll results, but there are other questions that indicate that Americans don't have a lot of confidence in the electoral process. I do think in most locations they feel, you know, if they go to the polls and cast a vote, that it will be counted. And, the question is whether one should be comfortable with 90% saying that and 10% not saying that. That seems a bit high to me. But I think we do have that kind of level of confidence. But polls also show that Americans don't think very much of elections in the sense that they feel that the candidates really are not forthright on the issues, that money plays too heavily in the electoral process, that the advertising is too negative. It seems more like, try to kill the other guy as opposed to prop up your own candidacy and the like. So I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the process. More narrowly, the question about the accuracy of the vote count, I think that's a smaller piece of it. But to say that Americans are happy with the way that we conduct elections, I think mistakes where the public is on this question.
Professor Thomas Patterson at Harvard, Carlin Bowman at American Enterprise Institute, back to you. What about that 91% figure? Is 10% lacking confidence too many? And is there a partisan breakdown? Are more Republicans confident or are more Democrats confident than the other way around?
There is a partisan breakdown in some of the questions now. We see this in many polling questions today about elections. But I think that 10% number is something that we should worry about. We should definitely be concerned about it. But I guess I'm impressed by the 91% number. I don't see that kind of a number very often in public opinion polling.
What's the partisan difference?
I don't have the breakdown, but on some questions, Democrats are more pessimistic, and on others, Republicans are. But in this election, Democrats tend to be more pessimistic given the experiences in 2000 and 2004.
Okay, so that would make sense. Let me go back to Rick Hassan at Loyola Law School, the election law blogger. Do you think, you indicated earlier, you thought that all of these challenges and so on do lead people to lose confidence, and neither of our other guests seem to agree with that.
Well, I've looked at some of the NES data, which is pretty well-respected data, from 1996 to 2004, and we've seen an increased partisan divide. So let me give you the figures from 2004.
The NES, incidentally, National Election Service.
National Election Studies is at the University of Michigan.
Okay.
And what it showed was that about 22% of Democrats thought the 2004 election was somewhat or very unfair, compared to 3% of Republicans. Which is a huge gap. But if you look at, say, Washington State, where they had a contested gubernatorial race with the Democrat ultimately ending up on top after litigation, 68% of Republicans thought the election process was unfair compared to 27% of Democrats. And so what we seem to see is that retrospectively, the losers in the election have less confidence than the winners. And some of the recent data has shown not only a partisan gap, but also a race gap. So a recent Pew study showed that African Americans were much less confident in the election process than white voters.
What does that have to do with voter ID?
Well, some say, and I have not seen any studies to back this up yet, but some say that part of the reason for the lack of confidence on the part of African Americans is that they expect to bear the brunt of some of these voter ID laws, because African Americans tend to be poorer than white voters, and voter ID laws tend to affect the poor, who have a harder time getting these IDs or getting the documents they need for these IDs, and that this could contribute to the decline in voter confidence in these areas. That voter ID, which, by the way, in every state legislature that's passed it, it's been a Republican legislature that's passed these rules, and it's been opposed by Democrats, that this further erodes confidence by politicizing the election administration process.
Back to Professor Patterson at Harvard's Kennedy School. You mentioned legal efforts to keep down the vote. Is ID, or voter ID, rather, one of those or not?
Well, I would put it in that category. I mean, we'll see whether, as this works its way through the court systems fully, whether it's going to be upheld. But, you know, despite all of the talk about trying to prevent fraud, we're going to have 80 million people showing up at the polls tomorrow. And, you know, you're going to be lucky if there's even into four figures the number of people who are there illegally. We have very little of that kind of fraud in the system. But we have this long history of trying to use these devices like voter ID to suppress voter turnout. And we justify them, or we make the public argument, oh, this is designed to prevent fraud and the like, but it actually is aimed at particular groups in society. And as Rick says, it's primarily aimed at lower-income people for whom these are larger hurdles, to try to keep them away from the polls. And, yes, that is a Democratic constituency. And I think as we step back as Americans from this process, we ought to try to get the partisanship out of the election administration. This ought not to be a partisan issue. We ought not to have these devices. And as I said, we have a history of it. Everything from the white primary to the grandfather clause and the like, even registration when it first started, was not universal. It was imposed by Republican legislatures on Democratic cities and not imposed throughout states, so that, politicians know how to manipulate the vote, and given a chance, they'll try to do it. And I think that's where I would draw the line, that, they can try to win votes. They can try to discourage people from voting from the other party, but to have these devices, these artificial voter suppression devices, I think is something that we shouldn't tolerate. We've been more tolerant of it than other democracies. I think it's a blot on the way that we conduct elections. And somewhere along the line, I think we've got to figure out how to do this on the up and up. And we ought to be, as a more than 200-year-old democracy, mature enough to make that decision, but we seem to be stuck in that point. I mean, winning seems to be everything to some people in this game, and the cost to the democratic process seems to be a very small issue.
Carlin Bowman, you're with the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative group. One would think you tend Republican. Do you think that's fair to say that the Republicans have the history of trying to keep people away from the polls?
Well, what I'm going to talk about today is the polls, and I'd just like to bring one to your audience's attention. It's a late October Pew poll, and people were asked whether or not voters should be required to show an official photo identification, such as a driver's license, at the polls. And in the late October Pew poll, 78% of national adults said they should, and 18% said they shouldn't have to do this. And this is a finding that seems to me is in line with other polls that have asked a similar question during the course of this year. So this isn't something that a minority of Americans support. I certainly agree with Mr. Patterson that various political parties have imposed regulations at different points to try to affect the outcome. I think there's no question about that. But voter identification is something that's enjoyed wide, deep popular support for a very long time.
Do you think that there is, in fact, as Professor Patterson also said, really very little fraud taking place?
Again, I wouldn't be an expert on that. I'll defer to people who have more expertise in that area than I do.
Okay. Again, Carlin Bowman at the American Enterprise Institute. Rick Hassan, quickly back to you. What about this question of how much fraud there really has been?
Well, if you look at where the fraud, at least the prosecutions and the documented fraud has taken place, it's tended to be there's tended to be a lot of registration fraud, in part because we have a lot of places where people who register, the bounty hunters, are paid by the piece. And so we see a lot of that kind of fraud, but then Mickey Mouse, who's registered, doesn't turn up to vote, so it doesn't translate into actual election fraud. And then we have a fair amount of absentee ballot fraud, where absentee ballots are actually sold. And we've had cases like that, cases in Miami, cases in Georgia, where this has happened. These voter ID laws don't address that. The claim is that a lot of fraud is not being detected. And this is one of the issues, as these voter ID laws get challenged in court, this is one of the empirical questions that's being litigated right now. How much fraud is there? And so far, the evidence, I think, shows not really a lot of election fraud where people show up and claim to be someone that they're not.
All right. We will see how much of a challenge there is on that issue, on many of the others that we have talked about today as well, and how long it takes before we know the results of tomorrow's elections. Thanks, all of you, very much for being with us. Rick Hassan at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, Professor Thomas Patterson at Harvard's Kennedy School, Carlin Bowman at the American Enterprise Institute, and our other guests as well, Rob Hege, the general counsel for the Missouri Democratic Party, and Audra Miller, spokesperson for the Republican Party in Maryland. South Dakota's Jail for Judges measure would allow citizens to sue judges who made legal decisions they didn't like. It's the most draconian evidence of a national movement to control what backers call a system gone out of control. Is the judiciary at risk as an institution? More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z.
Werman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Constitution of the U.S. and those of the states provide for three branches of government: the legislature to make laws, the executive to administer, and the judiciary to make sure that the other branches conform to the basic principles of the Constitution itself. Oregon, Colorado, North and South Dakota all have ballot measures that would limit the independence of judges. Bert Brandenburg is executive director of the Justice at Stake campaign. That is a nonpartisan organization that's interested in the judiciary's independence. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Why is independence so important?
Well, if our courts cannot be independent, they can't be impartial. And Americans expect their courts to protect their rights, and they can't do that unless they are insulated from pressure from the politics of the day, from partisan special interests, and above all, from politicians who may have their eye on the next election. So if we want courts to be accountable to law and the Constitution, we need to give them the independence they need to make decisions without fear of political intimidation or political retribution.
But we live in a democracy. Why is it that any branch of government should be independent from politics?
Well, we don't want courts to be just independent. We want them to be independent and accountable. And however, there's a little bit of a difference between what a court does and a legislator or an executive does. We want executives and legislators to make promises on the campaign trail and then keep them. I will cut your taxes. I will increase your health care. On the other hand, that's not the way we want justice in America. We want judges to be keeping an eye on the law and the Constitution, not an eye on somebody who may be raising money for them or raising money against them, or in the case of the federal judiciary, particular attacks that may be going on. And we want judges to be able to make decisions, therefore, that can uphold rights despite whatever may be going on with the political debate of the day.
We hear often the complaint that unelected judges have made a decision of one kind or another that may be unpopular with somebody. If judges are unelected, as they are certainly in the federal system and as they are in many other places as well, how do you hold them accountable?
Well, every court except for the Supreme Court has its decisions appealable up the line. We have a confirmation process that is there to hold judges accountable. If there's actual misconduct, judges can be impeached. There are plenty of accountability mechanisms. Of course, in many of the states where judges are elected, there are election mechanisms as well as disciplinary review commissions. There are judicial performance evaluations and voter guides in a number of states. So there are a number of mechanisms, but again, to expect the courts to be accountable in exactly the same way that the other branches are would then undercut the rights that we expect courts to uphold for us.
Bert Brandenburg again, executive director of the Justice at Stake campaign. Let's talk about South Dakota and the jail for judges, with the Arabic numeral 4 being used in the phrase jail for judges initiative. What exactly would it do?
Well, it is pretty radical, and it would essentially wipe out something called judicial immunity, which allows a judge to make a decision and not be sued simply for making a decision somebody disagrees with. Of course, a judge should always be suable if they actually commit any legal misconduct that you or I would be liable for. But at the same time, going back to the Magna Carta and before, we've established the principle that judges have a job to do and make decisions that, you know, at least half the people involved are not going to like. And so it would say that this is gone, that judges could be subjected to firing for various, you know, offenses. It would mandate jury trials for infractions like parking tickets and dog license violations, and essentially tell the judiciary that they would constantly have to look over their shoulders at whoever might be angriest at them. Otherwise, they might be fired or have their benefits stripped from them.
Back to this question of holding the judges themselves accountable, you say that, of course, under any circumstances, they would be have to be tried if they had violated a law. This initiative, as I understand it, would create a grand jury that could authorize lawsuits or even criminal prosecutions against judges based on their rulings. Can you give me an example of how such a thing might happen in South Dakota were this to pass?
Well, this is essentially a fourth branch of government, and it would be accountable to no one else, and it would be using taxpayer money. And according to those who are worried about this in South Dakota, this is a group that could just decide they simply didn't like a criminal decision, or they didn't like the idea that certain evidence was excluded from a criminal trial, or they didn't like a particular tax decision, and they could then just decide simply the judge was out of hand. And then if they get three of these offenses, it's a sort of a three strikes and you're out proposal, they could then be fired from the bench and have their benefits cut.
Where did this come from?
California. It's the brainchild of a gentleman named Ron Branson, who tried to get on the ballot a couple times in California, but was not successful. And South Dakota was picked, I'm guessing, because it had the easiest rules in terms of the number of signatures you would need to get on the ballot. So South Dakota is their pet laboratory. There have been no claims that there has been a single South Dakota judge who made a single decision that anybody in South Dakota is supposedly upset about. It's simply an attempt to intimidate the judges and find a state where they can get on the ballot.
There are less draconian proposals in Colorado, in Oregon, and in North Dakota as well. What do you think has spurred all this?
Well, we are in a cultural upswing that happens from time to time. Throughout American history, there have been periods of time where judges generally at all levels, the state and federal side, have been subject to more criticism and attacks, and frankly, that's fine. It's a political cycle of history, and judges, by the way, should not be immune from criticism. However, we have seen in the last decade or so a real spasm of angry attacks and attempts to really intimidate the bench into making decisions not based on the rule of law, but based on the politics of the day. So you have the Schiavo episode, where you had Congress, at the behest of certain interest groups, tend to manipulate the jurisdiction of one particular case. You have some states where hundreds, or I should say millions of dollars, are being spent to try to essentially win the bench for justices who will be seen as serving particular interest groups, as opposed to trying to rule on the case and taking everybody's views into account. You have on the federal side threats of impeachment over particular decisions and attempts to strip jurisdiction. A lot of this is happening right now, and you know, again, to the extent that this comes and goes in political history and judges have to have, you might say, thick robes and thick skins, that's not necessarily the worst thing in the world. The concern we do have is that this current upswing may be with us for a while, because what I do believe is different from the previous upswings through history is that there is what we call an outrage industry now in place. This is good money for political consultants. You can go after judges every few weeks because they have to make decisions by definition that half the people involved don't like.
We got to leave it at that. We'll see what happens in South Dakota and elsewhere and follow this up. Bert Brandenburg, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.